again, thank God that it's come tonight. And I hope that what I have to say would be of some profit to somebody. It has been to me, I can say that. So I hope I can get it across that it might be to you as well. Could we read, first of all, please, in Mark chapter 14? Maybe I should say before I forget, maybe tomorrow night, and Tim, Lord willing, to speak about a little bit we learned when we were in Russia. Unfortunately, I don't have slides. I have them, but they're at home, so I'll just have to try and tell you. Paint a picture with words, I guess they call that. Mark chapter 14, please. And verse number 6. Jesus said, "Let her alone, why trouble ye her? She hath wrought a good work on me. For ye have the poor with you always, and whensoever ye will, ye may do them good, but me have not always." And for this expression at the first of verse 8, she has done what she could. 1 Corinthians, please, chapter 1. 1 Corinthians, chapter 1. And verse number 27. First Corinthians 1:27, "But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen them that for God."
But God has chosen the weak things, the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. Then go back, please, to Judges chapter 3. And read it, verse number 12. Judges 3 and 12, "And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And he gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and went and smote Israel, and possessed the city of palm trees. So the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord raised them up a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a man left-handed. And by him the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab. And Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges of a cubit length. And he did gird it under his raiment upon his right thigh. And he brought the present unto Eglon, king of Moab. And Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had made an end to offer the present, he sent away the people that bare the present. But he himself turned again from the quarries that were by Gilgal, and said, I have a secret errand unto thee, O king, who said, Keep silence. And all that stood by him went out from him. And Ehud came unto him, and he was sitting in a summer parlor which he had for himself alone. And Ehud said, I have a message from God unto thee. And he arose out of his seat, and Ehud put forth his left hand and took the dagger from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. And the haft also went in after the blade, and the fat closed upon the blade so that he could not draw the dagger out of his belly, and the dirt came out. Then Ehud went forth from the porch and shut the doors of the parlor upon him and locked them. When he was gone out, his servants came, and when they saw that, behold, the doors of the parlor were locked, they said, Surely he covered his feet in the summer chamber. And they tarried till they were ashamed. And behold, he opened not the doors of the parlor. Therefore they took a key and opened them. And behold, their lord was fallen down dead on the earth. And Ehud escaped while they tarried, and passed beyond the quarries, and escaped unto Sirath. And it came to pass when he was come that he blew a trumpet in the mountain of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mount. And he before them, and he said unto them, Follow after me, for the Lord hath delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. And they went down after him, and took the fords of Jordan toward Moab, and suffered not a man to pass over. And they slew of Moab at that time about 10,000 men, all lusty, and all men of valor, and there escaped not a man. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. If I could put a title on what I have in my mind, and I hate to put titles on what I have in my mind because by the time I'm all said and done, people question whether I said exactly or anything related to what I said I was going to speak, but if I could put a title on what is in my mind and what I thought of, it's to try and get across to every last one of us that availability is more important than ability. It's more important to make myself available than it is to have great ability. Availability is far more important than ability. And if I spend all my time bemoaning my limitations, then I'll never accomplish anything. And not to get taken up with your limitations, but get taken up with a little bit of ability that God has given you. Because God has given every last one of us ability, and if the truth is known, there's not one of us, from the oldest to the youngest, that don't wish they had more ability, that they don't wish they were more gifted. And every person that preaches wishes they could preach like the next man that stands up that can do so much better. And everyone that does some other type of work or whatever it might be, we all wish that we had greater ability. And I would like to, I hope I could encourage you that you might get beyond the fact of ability and get taken up with availability and make yourself available. You see, where we read here in Judges chapter 3, you find that Israel is held in bondage. And they're held in bondage by Eglon, the king of Moab. If you go back and find out the beginning of Moab, you'll find out that it was the incestuous relationship of Lot with his daughter. And that's where it all started. And there's a picture to us in the Word of God of the flesh. And here's a man that's Eglon, the king of Moab, and he's got Israel held captive, held bondage, and for 18 years they've been held in bondage. They've been held captive by, if we can put it very simply, by the flesh. Look at it. The same thing that took place in that day is taking place amongst God's people today. And I think when most of us consider the flesh and think about the flesh, automatically, right away, we start to think, that has to do with morals and so on, and no doubt it has. It certainly includes that, but I believe it goes far beyond simply morals and sexual impurity and different things like that. The flesh goes far beyond that. We can be involved and taken up. I know the world and the flesh and the devil is very hard to divide, and it's hard to see the start and the finish of the one and the other, but I would suggest to you that the flesh is partly what is taken up with things. And I know that's involved in the world as well, but it's my flesh that wants that to, you know, if I can have a nice big car. And I don't mind to work overtime and work nights and everything else, as long as I can have that car with the nice rims on it and the stripes and all the rest of it and the big engine and all the fancy equipment, the buttons and the bells and the buzzers and the whole bit. You know, if I've got all of that, then I'm quite impressive, you know, and I can drive down the street and I can wind the window down and my, everybody looks in there and thinks, quite successful. And it, you know, brings a little bit of satisfaction to the old flesh, and a lot of us are held in bondage. In fact, not one of us are exempt from it in one way or another. But the trouble is, amongst the people of God, that is what is occupying people's minds, right, left, and center. Face the facts. Face the facts. I was speaking today with our brothers. We drove out to the country to visit, his first name is Brown. And as we were driving out in the country there, we were discussing what is the greatest problem, what is the greatest need amongst the people of God. I have absolutely no problem to see what, in my judgment anyway, is the greatest need amongst the people of God. We need brethren raised up of God amongst us, not to carry the gospel. Yes, that's tremendously important. There's a tremendous need for that. But the greatest need today amongst the people of God is men of God raised up and sisters raised up with a heart for the people of God and with a concern and a compassion and a love for the people of God that are prepared to set aside some of the time that could be occupied with so many other things. There's a tremendous need because the people of God are held in bondage. Just like in Israel's day, Eglon held the people of Israel in bondage, and it's no different today. I look every single way, and I look in the mirror, and I see myself and everyone else, and so much. We are held captive, and we're in bondage, and nobody cares. Just nobody cares. I tried to point that out on the Lord's Day. And I hope before I leave the place, at least, unless you ask me to leave right now, I'll pack up and go, and I'll take my plastic bag back there, and I'll just get my truck, and I'll be gone. But nevertheless, on the Lord's Day, I tried to express to you and to me, And when I speak to you, believe me, I'm speaking to Steve Kimber. What is a tremendous need? So exempt amongst us is dear brethren and sisters that will take time away from everything this old world has got to offer and take a look upon the people of God in tremendous need, because there's a lot of loneliness and a lot of sadness and a lot of sorrow, and we're losing young people right, left, and center. Oh, they can maybe even continue in the assembly, and maybe they can come to the prayer meeting and the Bible reading, go through the whole ritual, but losing them as far as a life that's lived for God. It's tragic. Absolutely tragic. That year after year goes by and nobody takes the time to sit down with the Word of God and tries to encourage the young and encourage the older to take their time and their life and their effort and use it for the glory of God. Why is it? Why is it that we're all taken up with everything and anything? You know why? We're held in bondage. Can't you see? Can't I see it? And we need men and brethren and sisters raised up of God with compassion and recognize a problem and begin to put in action, mobile, and begin to do something for the glory of God. And I'm not trying to bring myself into the situation, because I'll tell you something, I fail in so many ways. But I can remember 18 years ago now, when we began to, my wife and I began to talk about reality. And to say to ourselves, are we going to spend the rest of our life just cruising along, going to meeting and doing the whole bit, you know, and carrying on a few children's meetings and this and that? Or are we going to try and be a help and try and do something, whatever it is? And I look back to some of the happiest few years of our life in the assembly when we began to get a babysitter every Monday night. She came every Monday night. Sometimes we'd go for supper. My wife and I go for supper alone. And then we'd go with a purpose to visit. And every Monday night, and we did it for a number of years, and now I do it several nights a week, but I was working full-time. And I had lots of work to do. And believe me, there's a Tuesday night meeting where we gathered, and there's a Thursday night meeting, and there was a Friday night children's meeting, and there was all the other pressures and all the other responsibilities of raising a family and running a business and the whole thing. You know what it's like. And I look back to some happy, happy times when we started to go on Monday evening and we made up our mind we're going to visit two people, two families, every Monday night. Started with the old folks. You know what the biggest problem was? I'm going to tell you what the biggest problem was. The Christians. Not the old ones and not the young ones. The middle-aged ones. So, what's Stephen Merle doing anyway? They must think that they're the elders. And they must think that they're this and they're that. And a little bit of gossip went around. And I just didn't pay a particle of attention. I said, Merle, just forget all about it. And I'll tell you something. There was times we sat and got to know believers. You know, the first time you go to visit them, well, you know, you had a nice little chat. Talked about the work. You can only talk about work after so many visits. And you can only talk about the job and the business just so long. And then we started to try and go with a purpose, open the Bible up and read it together. And to pray together before we left. And you know, after a little while, sometimes after a few months of visiting folks, they started to open up. I'll tell you something, we started to learn a tremendous amount about the people and about ourselves. We had some wonderful times visiting old believers. They started to teach us things that had been silent about for years. And I look back and I value tremendously some of those nights we sat. And sometimes you go to an old folks' home and you sit there till the wee hours of the morning as they would begin to teach us things that they were silent on. I can remember one home going in to visit. And we sat down in that house. And a couple that had experiences in their life, they taught us things that we needed to learn. And they never would have taught if we hadn't arrived at the door and started to visit them. They started to teach us things about our family. And they made us conscious of things that I never even thought of before. And they made it conscious of realities. And if only there would be those raised up of God with a purpose of heart to take the time to try and deliver the people of God. Now I'm going to say this very honestly. I wasn't even conscious of it in my mind that I was trying to deliver the people of God. I enjoyed it. Oh yeah, I was nervous at first. But I became to enjoy it. And I would encourage that there's surely, in this gathering here tonight, surely there's someone, some dear couple that will take the time and begin to do it. You don't have to be what they call the elder. You don't have to be one of the old ones, one of the young ones. Just someone that looks upon the bondage in which the people of Israel are held in bondage, the people of God are held in bondage, and triumphs, by the grace of God, begin to do something to try and help to deliver them from the bondage in which they're in. And this, I believe, in some little way, is what Eglin decided to do, you know. He was one person in himself that rose up. He started to look around him. He started to see the problem, and he started to see the difficulty. 18 years it had been like that. And in some assemblies, it's been a lot longer than 18 years. Face it. You know it, and so do I. That for a long time, the people of God have been held in bondage by one thing or another. Oh yes, even though they come to meetings, even though they pray, even though they stand up at the breaking of bread and worship, and even though all these things might be true, they're still held in bondage. And I think you can see from the chapter here that there was tremendous bondage that people were held in, and at the same time they were held in bondage, there was certainly tremendous ability. And this man, Ehud, he rose up and he decided to try and do something. You know, there's something about Ehud. If you read farther along in Judges, a little bit later, you'll come along to chapter, I think it's chapter 20 and verse number 16. You'll find that Ehud, first of all, was a member of the tribe of Benjamin. Saul tells us it was the smallest tribe. But also, even though Israel was held in bondage, there was tremendous ability. And it's even amongst the people of God today. Though there's such bondage that we're held in, and we don't even recognize it. Just like Israel in that day, I suggest to you, they didn't even recognize the bondage they were held in. Oh, I know there was difficulties, and there was problems, and there was troubles, and they had to pay so much every year and so on to Eglon, the king of Moab, who held them in bondage. But nevertheless, you know, they didn't recognize the tremendous problem that was there. And there was tremendous ability amongst them, in spite of the bondage in which they were held. Tremendous ability. Because in chapter 20, or is it chapter 26, chapter 20, I believe, and verse number 16, you'll find that there was 26,000 Benjamites that drew the sword. So in spite of bondage, being held in bondage for off and on over the years, there was still 26,000 of them that drew the sword. So there was men of ability, just in the tribe of Benjamin, 26,000 men that drew the sword. But something else, there were 700 of them that could take with their left hand, and they could throw a stone so straight that they could throw it at a hair's breadth and not miss. And so there was ability amongst them. Not only the 26,000 that drew the sword, but 26,000 left-handed men that could take and throw a stone so straight that they could actually hit a hair's breadth. And I don't know what distance it was, but it didn't matter whether it was half the distance of this hall. Not many of us could do it. And Eglin, I'm going to suggest to you, he went out to take a look at them. Now, I'm going to use a little imagination, if you'll excuse me. But Eglin would go out and he'd start to inspect what they're doing. Why? Well, he's left-handed. But there's something different about his left hand than all the other 700 left-handed men. Because Mr. Newberry tells us he was not only left-handed, he was shut of his left hand. In other words, he wasn't born that way. It was something unnatural. Maybe it was a stroke. Maybe an accident. Maybe an amputation. I don't know. Whatever it was, his left hand didn't work. Just like his right hand didn't work, and so he was forced to use his left hand. And you could see him going along, and he's going out to check those left-handed men. Those left-handed men, they could throw so straight, but they were doing what came naturally. And they were working on what came natural. And they were working to improve what came natural. Like my brother, Paul. He's left-handed. When we were kids, he used to play ball, and sometimes I would try and throw with my left hand, like Paul could do it. He could throw just as good with his left hand as I could throw with my right. And I would try and throw with my left hand, but I could never throw with my left hand. And Eglin, he would go out and, can I suggest to you, he might try and join up with the left-handed crew. He's shut up his right hand, and he's using his left hand. But try as he might, I would say that he would come up as an army reject. And you might be able to look at Eglin and say, well, you know, what's he got? He just doesn't have the ability that the other men have, and he would try to do his best, but there he is. He can't accomplish what he would like to try and do, and he's shut of his right hand, and he would have to say that he doesn't have the ability of those other men. He doesn't have the ability to draw the sword like those other men. He doesn't have the ability to throw left-handed like those other men. And if that man, Eglon, had begun to bemoan his limitations, you know, where would he ever arrive? Where would he ever amount to? What would he ever amount to? Would he ever amount to anything? Well, he wouldn't amount to much if he began to bemoan his limitations. That's why I like Mark chapter 14, verse number 8. She did what she could. She did what she could. And Eglon, I believe, is a man, if you take a look at the chapter, you will start to see that Eglon, Ehud, began to try and to do what he could. Just to try and do what he could. There's a man, he had several strikes against him, not only shut of his right hand, but he came from Benjamin, the most insignificant tribe of them all, according to King Saul. And such an insignificant tribe. So he's got a few strokes against him. Maybe some of you here tonight have got the same strokes against you. Maybe you would have to say, well, I'm more of an insignificant family. It's not my family who has, in the years past, been such a blessing in the assembly. It's not my family who has run the assembly. My father was never an elder here, and maybe I came from the outside, and I came, whatever, I hate calling people strangers. In fact, let's call them visitors. But whatever, you've come from the outside, and I don't even like that term. But anyway, there you are. And you don't come with the same, you don't have the same background the others had. That's Ehud for you. He came from an insignificant tribe. He's got a few strokes against him. And yet, he is going to try and do what he could. That's why I read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 27, that God has chosen the weak things of this world to confound the things that are mighty. And Ehud there, is, with all his limitations, he takes a look around and he sees the situation. And he doesn't get all taken up with what he can't do. He gets taken up with what he's going to try to do. Brother and sister, don't get taken up with what you can't do. Don't worry about what you can't do. Get taken up with what you can do. And just try and do something. If you take a look in the dictionary, you'll see that Ehud's name means union or harmony. Sometimes I think it takes more grace on the part of, for want of a better term, an outsider that has come in amongst the people of God. I sometimes think it takes more grace on their part and more kindness on their part to be united with the Christians than it does if, for myself, I was raised in a Christian home in the assembly and grew up in the assembly. You're just kind of a part of it from the very start. And maybe those that come in need to show, are forced to show more grace than others that are kind of in it from the start. And Ehud there, his name means harmony or union. And he would possibly have to work harder at it. And there he is. And he's going to try and to do what he... At least he's going to try and do what he can. So what's he do? Well, he goes out and he gets himself a piece of metal. And I suggest to you the reason he had to get a piece of metal and he had to make his own dagger is because as he went out and... they're held in bondage. No doubt those who are holding them in bondage would pick up all the spears and would pick up all the daggers and would pick up all the swords and they would take all the weapons and they would keep these people in bondage by taking all these things off them. And Ehud, if ever he is going to be able to do what he can do, he has got to take and go to work alone. And he takes a chunk of metal and he takes a stone and he begins to work with it. And he begins to grind out a dagger for himself, a cubit long, maybe 18 inches long or 20 inches long, however long it would be. And that man begins to work on it, and he begins to strive, and he begins to try and do whatever he can do. You know, he didn't borrow one, and he didn't beg one, and he didn't take last year's old beat-up model. You know, he began to work on one for himself. And if I can say this, now when it comes to preaching, I don't know about the rest of you, but I beg, borrow, and steal. And anything that comes across the platform is free game, as far as I'm concerned. Nothing belongs to you. And if I hear you say something and it sounds good to me, I'll write it down. And I might use it sometime. But I want to tell you this, there is nothing that can replace getting alone with God with this book. And taking time alone with the Lord and sitting down with this book all by yourself. Oh, maybe you don't have great ability to study. And maybe you're like me and like most of the others here and every last one of us. You don't know the Greek. And you don't know, maybe you don't have a lovely library full of all kinds of books. But my, you got this book. And you sit down and you begin to read this book. And to study this book just a little bit. And spend a few minutes a day at it. I'm not going to be like the brother that stayed with us one time and maybe he was as bad as me, I don't know. But he got up and he said, no,
He was really ranting and raving. He told the Christians that there shouldn't be one of us here today that haven't read their Bible for 1 hour a day. Well, I was a little bit taken back. I thought to myself, give me an hour? Well, I don't know if he knows what it's like to struggle through the traffic in the morning and get up in the morning and struggle through the traffic to get to work. Obviously, he didn't know what it was like. And I don't know if he understands what it's like to work in an office all day long and have a few minutes at lunchtime and sometimes the phone rings then. And I don't know if he knows what it's like to get off work at 4:30, 5 o'clock and get all the way back home. And maybe he doesn't understand what it's like to get home and maybe help your wife get the supper ready and finally get the kids off to bed, and after you've played with them for an hour and a half and you're dead beat and you sit down in your Bible and you fall asleep. I don't know if he understood that. And obviously, he didn't, because he was staying with us. And the next morning, I started, and each morning thereafter, and my wife told me, look, Steve, you just leave well enough alone and don't say a word. But I started to check under his doorway when I was up, and it was dark. And I started to check quite as late as possible. I said, please, dear wife, go up there and check yourself and see. I'd like to know what time he's getting up. But you know something? There he is, sleeping, doesn't know anything about it. I'm not trying to suggest to you it takes an hour a day. You don't have an hour a day. And I know you don't have an hour a day. And I had a nice little discussion with him about it. He never apologized. But nevertheless, a few minutes. Sure, you've got a few minutes a day to take and begin to read a passage and meditate upon it. A number of years ago, a brother said to me, he said, Steve, you know, how do you read? Or what were you reading? Or how are you going about your reading? I said, oh, I don't know. I kind of read. You know, I try and read. And I did. I tried to read each day a little bit. He said, can I make a suggestion to you? He said, it was a suggestion to me years before. And I'll tell you who it was. It was an old man that we were visiting one night in the house. And I never forgot what he told me. And it's done me a lot of good. Maybe it'll do you some good. He said, forget about reading chapter after chapter through the Bible. Forget it. He said, the best thing to do is just take, for instance, he said, take Timothy and begin to read it. Make up your mind, okay, I'm going to read it once a week, 1st and 2nd Timothy. And he said, read it this week. And he said, next week, start over, read it again. And he said, next week, read it again. And the week after, read it again. And he said, the week after that, read it again. And he said, read it for 6 months, once a week, all the way through, every time, for 6 months, once a week. I started to do it. And then he said, after that, pick out Philippians and read it, and read it, and read it, and read it, and read it. And read it over and over and over again, because till it becomes a part of your mind. And he said, it'll do you a lot of good. You want to know something? It did me a lot of good. And maybe if you would do it, I think it will do you a lot of good. If you want to keep reading chapter by chapter through the Bible, that's okay too. I wouldn't suggest to stop. But somehow or other, I get started into Ezekiel and some of those books, and it gets very, very struggling, tough going. It's like when we were kids, and you get on the old Bloom tire bike, and you ride it down the road, and you turn in a pathway, and you find there's 4 inches of mud, and you got to work pretty hard to get the thing through. And after you're all the way through, you're huffing and puffing and panting, and you're not sure what is that. And that's exactly how it is when sometimes. And I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't read your Bible all the way through. But here's a man by the name of Ehud. And if I see what he's trying to do, he's sitting down and he's beginning to make a dagger. And he works on it and he grinds away at it and he works at it. He starts to make that hand. The old handle on that dagger starts to fit his hand. It starts to feel good. It starts to fit. And then he starts to work on the old blade and he works on it and he works on it. You know, it takes a time to come alone, a little bit by yourself to do that. And he works on it, and I don't know how long he worked on it. Look, worked on it, no doubt, for a long time. And he's working away, and he's working away. He's making a dagger. Not only is he making that dagger, but he starts to, with his left hand, if you read carefully in the chapter, he fits it to his right thigh. That 18-inch long dagger, however long it was, maybe it was shorter. But he makes that dagger, and he fits it to his hand, and I can see as he would shave the hair off the back of his arm, see how sharp it is. And then he would put it against his thigh. What do I mean by that? He applies it to himself before he ever applies it to somebody else. You know, I said at the start when I was here on Sunday, I said, well, one of the problems I have with minister meetings are that you come down and you talk away and you try and say at least what you think. Whether you're out to lunch or not, you still try and say what you think. And you try and get across your thoughts and try and get across a point. After everything's all said and done, you shake hands at the door and you walk away and you drive home and everything just continues the same old way. And I've had it happen with me when others have come and ministered, and I've sat there and listened, and it sounded very good. And I thought to myself in meeting, yeah, I've got to make some changes in my life. And I get out, and by Monday noon, you know, I forgot all about it. And somehow or another, it just goes back into the same old rut. I wonder why that is. I've asked myself, why is that? Why doesn't it work? Why isn't it effective? I wonder. The reason it's not effective, possibly, is because I don't do what Ehud did. He applied it. You don't traffic in unfelt truth. And I've been guilty of a lot of times. Trafficking in something I got from a book. And it really didn't mean anything to me. And I thought it sounded good. And I thought, I'll get it across to the Christians. And I don't know what they thought. Maybe they thought it sounded fine too. But it didn't have an effect. Why not? Is it because I was trafficking in unfelt truth? Is it because it didn't make any impression on me in the first place? So how can I ever expect it to make an impression on somebody else? And maybe that's why the gospel works better. Because the gospel made a tremendous impression on my heart, my soul. And so did it in you when the Lord saved you. And we begin to tell others about it. And it lives in our life, in our heart. And they can see it. It's real to them. Should that not be the way it is when it comes to the ministry? That first of all, it has touched me. And I believe with Ehud here, I would suggest to you that it touched him. The one thing I like about a dagger, it's not like a spear. With a spear, I think, I don't know too much about spears, but I don't even know much about daggers. But I'll tell you one thing about a spear. A fellow that is a good spear thrower, I understand, can stand back, according to the encyclopedia, he can stand back a long way and he can toss a spear. And some of them get tremendously accurate. You don't even have to get close to your target. You can stand a whole long way back. And my, you can let fly. And you can take the man down, no matter where he is. Almost. That's with a spear, but not with a dagger. You know with a dagger? You've got to hold her in your hand. And you've got to get up close. You know, Ehud, he's working on a dagger. Because he is going to get up close to the target. And might I encourage brother, sister, get close to one another. Get up close. As it were, you're coming with a dagger, not to use as a dagger. I don't even want you to think it's to try and use it as a dagger, but you're trying to deliver the people of God. And before you can ever deliver the people of God with a dagger, you've got to get close to them. Mr. Lorne McBain, maybe some of you here knew him. When we were kids growing up, he preached a lot of series of gospel meetings in Sarnia. In fact, my father was saved in 1936 in the first series he had there, and he had 13 series over the years. Something about Mr. McBain. He would come to the gospel meeting for a gospel series. And I wouldn't say that Mr. McBain was the greatest preacher in the world. Oh, he was all right. But he saw many souls saved. But I don't believe for one minute it was because of his tremendous ability in preaching. You know what it was? That man knew something about winning souls. Because he would have the gospel meetings and he would preach and tell you, he would talk to us kids and he was friendly and he was kind. Other preachers came, you know, and after the meetings were all done, they would talk to us too and they were friendly and they were kind. But after the meetings were all done, maybe a month later he'd be at a conference. You're walking down the hallway, here came Brother So-and-so. And he didn't even look at you. He walked by and said, what's wrong? He must... Not Mr. McBain. Mr. McBain would come out of his way at a conference and he'd look you up to find you. And then after the meetings were done and said and passed, 2 months later you'd get a letter in the mail. That was pretty rare, you know. And he always wrote, Master Stephen Kimber, with the address. And L.E. McBain in the top corner. I'll tell you something, I appreciated that tremendously. What was he doing? He was using a dagger, but he was getting up close. And in that page would just be one small page of paper, maybe with about 14 lines. And he would just tell you, I was thinking about you, how's school going? And I've been praying for you. And when he came back for meetings the next time, when I saw him at the conference the next time, he would come out of his way and talk to us. He knew us. He was a lot better than me. Some people say they can't remember names, but they can remember faces. Well, I got a problem. I can't remember either. And Mr. McBain, somehow or another, he was able to remember. And he came close and he got close to us and he talked to us. And he saw many souls saved, and many of us, and boys and girls growing up in Sarnia, were saved in gospel meetings that Mr. McBain had because he got close. And I believe it was the same when it came to getting saved. In fact, he was an old man when, well, a fairly old man when I was coming to get married.
You know, he phoned. I've been saved for a long time, or a number of years. Saved when I was 14. I was getting married when I was about little, almost 21. And Mr. McBain phoned. He says, "Steve, I just put some literature in the mail for you. I heard that you've been engaged and going to get married." He says, "I'm still praying for you." And I'll tell you something, he came close. And he sent literature, information, some help as far as marriage is concerned. You know what? Until the day that man died, he stayed close. And over the years, maybe once a year, you would, not at Christmas time, you'd get a card from him, maybe then, but once a year at least, after we married until the day he died, he would send a letter, just a few notes, a note in the mail, say, "I'm going through the list of people I write to," and he always wrote by hand, he didn't even have a computer. Until the day that Mrs. McBain died 2 years ago, his wife took up where he had left off maybe 15, 16 years ago after he died in Garnavilla Conference, and she took up where he left off. And until shortly before he died, she would write us and we would write her back. Why? Because they came close. You know what that is? That's a rarity amongst the people of God. And I'm going to say this. 18 years ago, by the grace of God, I trust it was, my wife and I determined that we were going to try and do what Mr. McBain did. Is there any here tonight that would try and do the same? It's not ability we need. It's availability. The Lord's people are suffering and they are hurting and they are lonely and they are sad. And there's so many difficulties. And yes, so something happens. And people come and help on that occasion when something happens. And when our son Jeffrey died, I'm thankful for the Christians that came. And 800 of them came to the funeral. Certainly we're most thankful for it. But know who I appreciated the most? Those that were close to us over the years. And know who they are? Very, very few. Is there not amongst the people of God, if I can make no other impression, leave this place, maybe never see again, whatever. It doesn't matter. If I could leave no other impression that there's those, when it comes to giving, we always think of dollars and cents. Forget it. What it is talking about when giving, when I'm thinking of giving, is not dollars and cents at all. I can go out and work, and I work. And others can go out and work. Don't worry your head about them. But time. I suppose the Lord could manufacture dollars and put in the mailbox for you. But when it comes to time, that's something that God doesn't manufacture. And there's a tremendous need. And is there anyone here tonight that would be an Ehud that would say, I'm going to try and do what I can? A man that's cut of his right hand, lame. Tell you something, the day came when there was, in Israel's day, in chapter 3 here of Judges, there's a tribute to be sent to Eglon. If you pick up the book of Josephus, the historian, and read what the tribute was, Mr. Josephus tells us that when tribute was taken, there would times be maybe as many as 300 and 400 slaves that would be decorated, dressed to the nines, decorated up very handsome and very beautiful and perfumed. And then all those men, slaves, would be loaded with bags and sacks and carts and everything else. And there'd be a beautiful procession that would be taken down to the king that is holding the country in bondage. And so Israel, held in bondage, had to pay tribute to those who held them in bondage. And so, they looked around all over Israel. There's 26,000 Benjamites, hundreds of others as well, but there's 26,000 Benjamites that drew the sword. Or maybe one of them. Or there's 700 of them that were left-handed that could throw and hit a hair's breadth. You'd say, well, surely you'll pick up one of them. Who did they choose when it came to take the tribute and to take the tribute down to Eglon, the fat king that held them in bondage? Who did they choose? They chose this man, Ehud. They saw a man that had a heart for the people of God. And they chose him. Out of the whole pack of them, they chose him. And he was the one that had the honor, if I may call it that, to lead that group down there towards Eglon, the fat king of Moab. Quite a procession. Josephus tells us, only a very small write-up about it, mind you, but he tells us that it was a festive day. And it was a day of great rejoicing for the king and the country that held the captives bondage. And they would take gold and they would take silver and they would take all kinds of things that had been made and provisions and grain and wheat, you name it. They'd take her wagon loads of it. There it all go. And down he comes. And at the head of that procession is Ehud, with his right hand flopping beside him. And he goes down the way and they come to Eglon, the king of Moab, and they're received into his presence. And there all that provision is set before him, and there it all is, and the slaves stand up after laying it all down in order, and he's just got a few minutes there with Eglon, the king of Moab, maybe an hour or two or three. According to Mr. Josephus, it was a day's festivities. So however long, I don't know how long Ehud would spend in Eglon's presence, but I'll tell you one thing he did. In that amount of time that he spent in his presence, he got across to that man. He's trying to win him. He's trying to deliver Israel. And he's trying to bring the enemy down. And if I can say this, what my purpose here is tonight is to try by the grace of God to bring the enemy down that's holding us in bondage. And I suggest to you it's the flesh, and a great extent, that's got us immobile and holding us in bondage. And there he is. He's thinking to himself, I've got an opportunity to bring this man down, but he's got to get close to him. And he's got to get his confidence, and he's got to get his trust. And before you're ever going to be able to deliver the people of God, before you're ever going to be able to help that young sister, that young couple that haven't been saved long, or that old couple that are being attacked by the devil and are discouraged, before you're ever going to be able to deliver them, you've got to take the time to get close. And Eglon, there, is looking at Ehud, and Ehud gains his confidence and gains his trust. And after all the procession is over and everything's all said and done, there they all leave and they go back by the quarries. And then Ehud says, I've got a message for the king. You keep on going, I'm going back to see the king. And it seems to me in the chapter anyway, some would say that he didn't leave the palace. Whether he did or whether he didn't doesn't really matter. He goes back to the king's presence and the king receives him into his personal presence. And then he says to the king that I've got a message for thee from God. And before ever you and I can be a help to one another, to give a message to one another from God, you've got to gain the confidence of the brother or the sister. You know, Galatians 6:1, you which are spiritual, restore such an one in a spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be... How's it go? But considering thyself, if you're going to deliver the... If you are going to be one that's going to be able to deliver the people, as Galatians 6:1, if you are ever going to be the one that's going to be used, you've got to get close. You can't just go when the brother or the sister falls into trouble and falls into sin or some trouble or problem that arises. You've got to be there long before that. If you're going to come in the spirit of meekness to restore such an one, they've got to have your confidence. It's good to show up anyway. But how much better if you've been showing up for months ahead of time and maybe they never got into the condition they're in. But if you're going to restore such an one, you've got to have their confidence. And Ehud has got the confidence of Eglon. And Eglon stands up. He's actually got not only the confidence and the trust, he's got the respect. Because Eglon stands up to receive the message from God. Not only does that, he has so much respect and confidence and trust, he sends all his soldiers, all his guards, all his aides, he sends them out of the room. And they close the door. And there he stands and he receives the message that comes from the God of Israel. And Ehud reaches with his left hand to his right thigh and he pulls out the dagger. And he gives them the message and he plunges it into his belly. And we read that it went in so deeply that the shaft went in behind the blade and he was so fat he couldn't pull it out and the dirt came out. And Eglon, that fat king of Moab, fell down dead. And there, the one who had gained his trust, he was able to deliver the people of Israel. And then he walks to the door and he steps out the door and he gently closes the door and I suppose calm and quiet, he walks away and says goodbye to the guards and the soldiers and everybody else is there. And you can see in the story how he goes down. And some time passes before the servants become embarrassed and ashamed that they haven't been in to see about the king. And they finally open the door and go in and they find him dead. But by this time, he has gone back He's able to stir up the children of Israel to come and follow him. And they go down, and that day 10,000 of the children of the Moabites, those lusty men, are killed. And Israel is delivered. And for 80 long years they enjoy peace. Why is that? Why is it? I'll tell you why they enjoy peace. It's because somebody did what he could. For 80 years they enjoyed peace. In fact, of the 13 judges of Israel, they'll find that that's the longest period of peace they enjoyed because of one man who tried to do what he could do. You'll excuse me, but I'm going to tell you that I hate using personal example, but I hope you'll excuse the fact that I'm not trying to lift myself up. Because I'm only trying to use it as an example. I mentioned, we've been 6 years in the place where we live. I spoke to my wife on the phone today, and she said, you know, Marg up the road, who is a neighbor up the road, who has been to the house two or three times, wants to see the pictures of Russia, another time to a thing. We have never, ever, once, on any occasion, preached to Marg, who is a neighbor that lives about four houses up the road. Not once. Haven't so much as opened the Bible with her. We've talked about what we tell the people in Russia and so on, and we sing hymns when they come down and so on, but we have never preached to her, and I haven't even tried to preach to her. She called my wife this morning. She says, you know, my mother is old. She's 93. And she says she's dying. She said, my father was a Presbyterian minister, which we knew. And she said, my mother is dying. She's old. Although I shouldn't say she's dying. She's very old. But she said, my mother is afraid to die. And she said, I've been thinking of who I can get to go and visit my mother. And she said, all the time, for the last few weeks, I've been thinking of you. And she said, would you go and visit my mother? Because she has been telling me that she's afraid to die and she wants to talk to somebody. And she said, I don't know who else to get her to talk to. And we have never once preached to that girl, not once. What is it? I believe I'm going to suggest to you, it is coming close and trying to get close. And trying to show kindness and trying to show friendliness, be it amongst the neighbors, be it amongst whoever it might be amongst. I mentioned in Ashfield last night, I'm going to mention it again. When I was growing up as a boy in Sarnia, we lived on a street, not quite as busy a street, or crowded a street as here, but in an area of a lot of older houses and so on. The yards were possibly a little bigger and the houses a little bit farther apart. And in the evening, my dad would... I can't tell you how many hundreds of times he would start off in the evening after supper and he'd sit down, read the newspaper a little bit and help mom or us kids or whatever. And then he'd say, well, let's go for our walk. And almost three, four nights a week, from summertime and all through into the fall and early in the spring and sometimes in the winter, he'd go off and mom would go with him and the kids, whoever wanted to, would come along, and we'd walk up the street, and you'd stop, and you'd talk to the different ones along the way, to Mrs. Hutchison, you'd stop and talk to her if she was outside, just be friendly, talk to her. Then you'd talk to other ones, and chit-chat here and chit-chat there, and after a while, you know, it came to be known that whenever the kids came home from school, if their mother wasn't there, well, you can always go down to Mrs. Kember, because she's got lots of kids, and a few more won't matter anyway, you can go down there, and it became... The fact that we got to know the neighbors within a few blocks close by, right close around, we got to know them. The one lady I think of in particular, I mentioned her last night, was Mrs. Avey. Her son, her father, when her husband died, she called my mother who lived in Sault Ste. Marie and asked if she knew anybody at the Gospel Hall or the church where we went in Sarnia to take the funeral. My mother had been left there for a few years. Whenever we go back there to visit Mrs. Avey, she hugs you at the door and kisses us. Doesn't matter whether it's me or my brother, whoever it is. And yet all those years, Mrs. Avey never stepped one foot inside our house. We went to her house many times. Her husband was an abusive man. Many times you'd hear him screaming and yelling and fighting and beating them. And my dad would just wander over and go in the yard, and Mrs. Avey would be so glad to see him. And then their son committed suicide. My mother is in the sewer, and she called and asked if she could get somebody from the church to take his funeral because they were irreligious. Just a few months ago, or maybe a couple of years ago, I met the oldest boy, Keith. He's a little bit older than me. He's next thing to an alcoholic and been a womanizer all his life. He looks a wreck. Looked terrible when I met him. When I saw him, I met him in Sarnia when I was there one day. I said, Keith, how you doing? And we talked for a little while. You know what he said?
He said, "Do you remember I used to go to the Sunday school there at your church there in Sarnia?" He said, "My, the Christians were kind." And he says, "Right till this day, when I meet the Christians from that church," he says, "or the people from that church," whatever he called them, he said, "they're so kind. Even today, not saved, the mother not saved. And yet, even to this day, they appreciate. What was it? It was coming near and drawing close by and trying to be a help and trying to understand the problems. We're not out there to preach to the neighbors so much. We're not out there to try and preach them into heaven or into hell or tell them only as opportunity opens the door. But oh, if we could only be kind to the neighbors and show tenderness and compassion, and then could it go farther beyond that? And in amongst the Christians, we should be spending our time encouraging and helping the people of God. And as a result of it, we would not be losing the Christians. We would not be losing young people." I was telling a brother today that in Ontario, there's a tremendous exodus amongst the people, amongst the assemblies. Young people are leaving, and they're going. I don't know where all they're going. I'll tell you something, you could weep when you stand and look. Oh, I'm thankful for the hundreds that come to a conference and are there. But you could weep when you stand and you look and you talk to them and you see the ones that are leaving. Such potential for God. And we can have all the excuses. And we can say we are too busy. But I don't believe for one moment that is ever going to stand up at the judgment seat of Christ. We have time. We have so much time for other things. Could we not organize our time enough that we could at least each of us have one evening a week to set aside for God to try and be a help, from the youngest sister here to the older one, that you might try and be a help and an encouragement? How much an older brother and older sister would appreciate a visit from a young brother or a young sister? I couldn't tell you how much they'd appreciate it. And know what would happen? You would end up delivering the people of God. Shall we pray?